Today we're going to we are going to listen attentively to some county perspectives on mental health programs, and we're pleased to have with us Rob Rockstrow and Sharon Gadara. Do you want to come up together, I assume? Enter and sign in, please. And make sure you pull those mics close and develop an intimate relationship with it, because otherwise the folks in the back can't hear.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Sharon Gadara, and I am the executive director for Mid-Columbia Center for Living. And I'm going to start out, and Rob Rockstrow, who is the director for Lane County's Human Services, is going to follow my testimony. I am, as I said, the director of a four-county behavioral health organization. We cover Hood River, Wasco, Sherman, and Gillam counties, and we provide the addiction services, mental health services, and developmental disability services for the four counties. We are organized as an ORS 190 intergovernmental agency. I'd like to, my handout is the overview of the community mental health system, and on page 2, as I'm sure most of the members are familiar, ORS 430 spells out the relationship between the state and the counties, and it also provides the legislative policy in terms of development of the mental health and developmental disability and also addiction systems. The three things I'd like to point out, I'm not going to go over page 2. You can read some of the statute yourselves, but the Department of Human Services and other agencies are charged to conduct their activities in the least costly and most efficient manner, and also to the greatest extent possible, mental health services shall be delivered in the community where the person lives. ORS 430 .630, which is at the bottom of the page, spells out the county commission's role as the local mental health authority. And with my organization, that actually is four counties, and I have one county commissioner on my board from each of the counties, which acts as the local mental health authority for those four counties. On page 3, this is a plea no matter what committee I've been testifying before, but public policy can no longer afford to ignore and treat mental illness and addiction services as optional. About 1 in 5 Americans experience a mental disorder in the course of the year, and approximately about 15% of those people also have a co-occurring substance abuse disorder. Mental illness is a brain disorder, and left untreated or inappropriately treated, mental illness can and does result in death. And in the Global Burden of Disease study, in terms of disability, mental health and addictions accounts for 3 of the top 10 disabling diseases in the world. Mental illness only after cardiovascular disease accounts for more disability than cancer. And I'd also like to point out that the Supreme Court ruling under Olmstead says that it is a form of discrimination under the ADA when states fail to find community placements for individuals with disabilities, thus causing them to remain in institutional settings, such as state hospitals, jails, nursing homes. I believe with the deconstruction of the community system that we are in harm's way, or the state is in harm's way, for a class action suit similar to Staley. As you're also probably well aware, other systems that are impacted by persons who have mental illness or addictions are the schools, foster care systems, juvenile adult corrections, and so on down the list on page 3. In the state of Oregon, we have 32 community mental health programs, often referred to as CMHPs, representing 36 counties. They operate either as county-operated systems that deliver all of the services or contract some of the services. A number of counties contract with private nonprofits who provide the services, and then Mid-Columbia stands out as the only ORS 190 intergovernmental organization. Also, the Confederate Tribes, the Warm Springs, delivers mental health services and receives funding from the states. There are 9 mental health organizations to serve the 36 counties for people covered under the Oregon Health Plan. 19 private agencies, which are contracted with the state, and 23 communities hospitals. Most community mental health organizations either provide or contract for the mental health, developmental disabilities, and addiction services, and many of my remarks are going to cover those three service areas. The legislatively approved funding to the community is primarily through the financial assistance agreement and other contracts with DHS agencies. On page 5, I have provided you with some comparisons for FY 2002 and then looking down to the proposed budget in terms of statistics and costs of services in the state versus the community system. Across all community components, 100,000 adults and children were served in the community system with an average cost of service per person of $2,250. Bob Nichols provided me with that number yesterday. State hospital system served approximately 2,485 folks, and those average cost of service per person was $138,000. In FY 2002, according to a handout by Dr. Brand, 25% of the state budget went to state hospitals and 75% of the state budget went to the community system. If we look ahead to the proposed budget for 2003 and 2005, we'll see a drastic shift. 54% is budgeted to the state hospitals and 46% is proposed for the community system, reflecting the level of cuts that the community system is experiencing. If we do the math on the dollars that are on the table, cost per state bed right now, or proposed for 2003-2005 biennium, is $127,593 per year, with an average cost per person served in the hospital of $83,000. If you look at the average cost per person served in the community per year, and I did reduce those numbers by 40% to reflect the reduction in service capacity, it adds up to $1,476 per year. On page 6, I have provided you with the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs principles and values for system redesign, and I won't read through those. They're in front of you, but just to emphasize that the system should be consumer-centered, and the system primarily should be community-based with services management, funding, and decision-making at the community level, and also that Oregonians should have access to services locally in their areas of residence. If you refer back to the ORS, to the statutes under 430, you would see that many of the pieces in the values and principles statement mirror the policy that's set forth in the Oregon statutes. On page 7, I have a sheet. It's called Factoids, the Mid-Columbia Center for Living Service System in our 4 counties, and it's my attempt to explain to this committee. I'm a very small service system compared to Lane and certainly to Multnomah County. The total number of people in our 4 counties is about 50,000 total, and we serve about 2,500 per year. within that system, well, we have the four counties. Two of the counties, Gillam and Sherman County, are so small they only have about 2,000 residents. It didn't make sense for them to have their own behavioral health system. Within also the Eastern Oregon region, which we're aligned, there are three regional organizations funded by DHS. I deal with four local child and family commissions funded by the state in those four counties. Also, if you look at my total budget revenues, I have six state agencies contracting for services directly or through other local contractors or reimbursing funds based on fee-for-service billings. We have four state-mandated advisory boards and committees that we must attend and work with. Actually, the number was five, but I collapsed my mental health services and the local alcohol and drug advisory committee, which is the LADPC, when the state at least put together their mental health and addictions office. I have four county contracts and four contracts from other entities, and Mid-Columbia also contracts out for 20 to 24 other either agencies or other professionals. I couldn't even come up with the number of local partners that we were at the table with, so I just gave you a snapshot of who the most prominent are that we work with. Within also our contracts with the state, we have seven different plans that we need to submit. And under our contracts with the state, they fund us under 21 different service elements. This is across mental health, developmental disabilities, and also addiction services. And many of these service elements, their descriptions go on for two or three pages, pretty detailed. Within the services that we directly provide, there are 44 Oregon administrative rules that govern our programs and the provision of services. And if you look at the note below, under each of those administrative regulations, they may have anywhere from 15 to up to 25 standards that we must follow and implement as we're going through and doing our services. We have 62 revenue sources for funding, and also we provide the state, they have eight different client data processing forms that we must submit on the people that we provide services to across those areas. I don't think if we tried, we could make a system more complicated. Just, I meant to say as a way of introduction, and I didn't mention it, I've been with Mid-Columbia for 8 years and came here in 1994. Prior to that, I worked for the state of Nevada at the state level for their Office of Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. And Nevada has a very different system. We ran both the state and the community systems. And unlike here, the counties ran the social services, the child welfare, and adult welfare systems.
So which system worked better?
Well, one thing that is very, very interesting, Representative Westland, is that my expectation when I came to Oregon and was told this was a state community partnership and the counties ran the community system, if I had to say, it was probably more of a community system in the state of Nevada, in that they have CMHP set up just like the state of Oregon does, but it was the county agencies that built the budgets that then went up to the state central office, and then the state central office took those budgets and fit it into a total budget. If cuts were coming, those were done first at the community level, sent up to the state level that put them together. So in some ways, I thought that the community agencies in Nevada actually had a lot more flexibility and discretion mm-hmm. with running the local systems. One of the downsides, I think, to the fact that the counties didn't own the systems is Nevada missed out in a lot of leveraging opportunities. In other words, many of the counties provide monetary assistance to help with the cost of services. Sometimes if it's not monetary, they provide a place, a building for us to be in, or they allow us to use their county council. So I think if you could meld the best of both models, you would probably have a pretty ideal system. For your information, the service tables I've attached are service tables. If you went to the very back of your document, they're just a few pages in, and it's for your information. They look like this. And what I'm attempting to do here is show you the services that we provide with the funded budget we had in FY 2002. And then those services in red, I have it broken down, one table for children and one table for adults, are services that in the next fiscal year will not be available to non-covered populations unless that they can come up with payment for those services.
And this is just out of mental health, not OHP?
This is mental health, but it includes the services that are funded by the state and also by the Oregon Health Plan. So for both the indigent and Oregon Health Plan population.
Mr. Chair, can I ask? Good afternoon. If they're not available for non-covered populations, what are the people who need those? What's going to happen to the people who need those services?
Well, that's kind of the million-dollar question. What we're anticipating, one thing is that the emergency service system at the hospitals are going to have to step up to the plate. And I actually have two letters from the CEOs of our hospitals. Right now, it's my understanding that the standard population, even though they lost their chemical dependency and mental health benefit, that the ER hospitals can be reimbursed for services. What's going to happen is we'll most likely be in a role of triaging people uh-huh. as they need to the physical health side when possible, the ER hospitals, and some of them will have to facilitate hospitalization at the state. It's not a pretty picture.
Did you have a follow-up, Mitch?
No, I'm just sort of troubled by the picture. I don't.
How are hospitals reimbursed if the community mental health providers aren't able to be reimbursed?
Well, it's my understanding, of course, it's my understanding that in FY... next fiscal year, FY 03-04, there will be no coverage for the standard population. So I think that would follow under the rubric of charity care for the hospitals.
So, I mean, they're not reimbursed. They might cost shift, but they're not...
Right, they're not directly reimbursed.
Okay. I misunderstood.
Okay, turning back to page 8... I provided you with a snapshot of the funding sources by clients served in 2002, and that first block where it says Oregon Health Plan and then total MHS, I'm sorry, that should have been labeled more carefully. That is the mental health clients. And if you can see, it's the numbers served in the first column, so 782 people were provided services under the Oregon Health Plan, which constitutes 73% of our clients in mental health were covered by the Oregon Health Plan. So you can see when the standard package went and then when the plus goes, 73% of the coverage for people seeking mental health services in our systems is gone. The second row there under says total AOD, which is alcohol and other drug services. If you look at the OHP side, 245 people were provided addiction services, and 34% of the coverage was under the Oregon Health Plan for those services. I'd just also like to point out 26% of the people that were provided addiction services were covered under the Indigent Dewey Funds, driving under the influence of intoxicants. If you look at the total, you combine unduplicated the mental health clients and the addiction clients served in FY 2002, fully 57% of them were covered by the Oregon Health Plan in our system. And for a number of clients, we do offer sliding fee scale. Well, we did. We are not now, but we did offer sliding fee scales for those clients, mostly the working poor or fully indigent that couldn't afford to pay our services. And at the very bottom of the page, I just have to point out we had an accounts receivable of over $215,000 at the end of 6/30/02, June 30. It is very near impossible sometimes to collect money from a number of the people that seek care in the public health system. If there aren't any questions about the system stuff, I'm going to kind of switch gears in the next pages, page 9.
Sure. Okay. Thank you, sir. Can I go back? I mean, I'm still troubled. We've always had mental health patients, and we've always had ways to see mental health patients when they get triaged and something happens to them. And now we have a schizophrenic in an acute stage or bipolar person who's manic and shows up in an emergency room and they're diagnosed as needing services. And the answer is we just say, you're not covered anymore, so we're sorry we can't help you, and push them out the door?
Well, let me tell you how it works now with the emergency room. This is in Wasco County and also Hood River. Our hospitals, they're small rural hospitals. They do not have any psychiatric staff on board. So what we do, they immediately call us. We provide all the coverage on site at the ER room, and then either attempt, if the person needs to be hospitalized, to facilitate that hospitalization or give them an appointment. If the worst case scenario, which I am hearing right now, is next year we are no longer going to have any Oregon Health Plan funds in our budget, which you just saw 73% of our folks are covered by the Oregon Health Plan, and a lot of our state dollars are going to be covered, we are going to be left with a very minimal service system. So cuts up to 50, 60, 70% in our staff level. At that point, what we'll be able to do is provide a triage function. And that would mean we can assist the hospitals in calling Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center or, the state hospital in Salem area. But we are going to have very few staff left unless we can really beef up our private sector part of the business. And you can kind of see on that table, it's a small part of our business now, to try to back support and have the staff available to provide services for those people.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
Just a couple of quick questions. If you don't know the answers right now, just give them to us later, because you may well not know them. In your OHP population, do you have any idea what part of that population is the federally mandated minimums? The numbers you gave us, I would assume, are everybody that's in the population now, which is the mandated plus the the further package that we offer in the Oregon Health Plan. Do you have any idea how much that would shrink your base of who was covered and who was not covered?
In terms of the, so the OHP Plus is of that Oregon Health Plan piece of business, that's probably about 60% of our business on the mental health side. And on the alcohol and drug side, it's probably more like 30%.
So just to be certain, I'm sure, Mr. Chair, can I follow up?
Sure.
The 60% you're talking about is what you would retain, and you lose about 40% of the OHP program. Is that what I'm hearing? About 60% of the patients you see on the mental service side are OHP mandates. Mandated patients, OHP plus patients.
Representative Bates, yes. I think I'll check the accuracy of those numbers, but 60% of the people that we see are going to be covered under the Oregon Health Plan plus population, which I understand is off the table for next 03-05.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up with another question? When that schizophrenic patient leaves the hospital, you said he's given, or he, she is given a appointment for referral. Could you give me more information about that? I mean, how's that referral made? How's the appointment made? It's 3 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday night, and you've determined this patient does not need to be hospitalized. What happens next to that patient on your present plan?
On our present plan, what happens is our worker is right down there with the person at 3 o'clock in the morning and coming up with the plan if they don't need to be hospitalized, if they have, number one, any family available in the area, then we are contacting and working with the family to develop a safety plan for that person and assistance to come into our agency the very next morning for services. If they don't have a family or friends, and typically, say, if they're even homeless, we will usually put them up for a night, and then through our case management services, come out, pick them up, transport them into our clinic, have the, you know, whether they have to see the doctor for medications or whatever, then follow up that way. So usually the beauty of how it works right now, Representative Bates, is we can pick them right up in the ER room and either facilitate the hospitalization or facilitate them right into our system. With that disconnect that's going to happen, crisis services are eliminated right now. I think that's going to be a more difficult scenario for that follow-up to occur.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let's fast forward a few months from now, and let's say crisis center isn't there. What are you doing with that patient now? Schizophrenic patient, knowing you've got no way of getting them to outpatient health care, mental care, what would your decision be different about whether you would hospitalize the patient at that time or not? Would it affect your decision to hospitalize the patient?
Well, first,
if you didn't have a way of getting them by sort of hands-on to the outpatient care, would that patient be back in the emergency room a few nights later, or would they actually get to where they're supposed to go?
Representative Bates, at that point, one, the hospital would, staff would be in the ER room facilitating that person's entry into the hospital, say if it's the 3 o'clock in the morning scenario. But it, short of not needing hospitalization, the staff in, at the ER room, I imagine, would discharge the patient with a ticket that says at 8 o'clock in the morning, go to the mental health center. And the chances of that fully happening, zero. I would like to hope maybe 15-20%.
Last question, Mr. Chair. How do you measure your outcomes in your program you've got now? How do you tell if you're making an impact in mental health in your community?
Well, we have a number of indicators that we're following that actually are mandated by the Oregon Health Plan program evaluation plans. One, we do yearly extensive consumer surveys that ask about satisfaction and outcomes. We track our hospitalization rates and to see if people are being hospitalized, discharged, rehospitalized. We also track the number of people that become employed and start moving on with, you know, some productive parts of their lives. And we are coming up on a data, we have a data system that we can actually now start tracking progress on the, on their treatment goals. So that's going to be helpful.
Thank you. Thank you.
Please continue.
Okay, on page 9, one of the questions that's asked over and over with the drastic reductions that we have are what are the priority services? And then often the question is also posed to us is what, you know, what would you pick if you have the choice between A and B? And one of the contentions I make that often the choices are so constrained. I know that we're looking right now within the Oregon Health Plan, what can we buy? Can we buy prescription drugs or can we buy mental health and chemical dependency coverage? And I find this very frustrating when the DHS budget is $3.9 billion. Which is an increase over their actual dollars in 2001. I sat at a table. I'm also a member of the Local Government Advisory Council that advises the DHS director, and it was very interesting. Our last meeting, Gene Thorne posed the question, what are the core services in DHS? And she had county commissioners there. She had representatives from several different organizations, the mental health and just mental health, housing, services to the aging population. And it was interesting. Nobody wanted to grapple with what are the core services. If you're in a time of you have very little to give, and one person even made, well, that's the legislature's decision. And since I have the microphone, I'd have to say, I think in these type of times, we have to go back to basics, talk about what are the most basic services that we can afford, and I don't think it's an Einstein question. I think food, shelter, and clothing, number one, access to health services and public safety, and there should be some kind of litmus test across what we're spending in this state. It's a 12, I believe, billion-dollar budget total. What are these positions and programs doing? Are they doing those basic services or are they not? And I think we do have to make some choices. The second thing I'd like to point out, and I call this framing the Solomon question, well, what services would you choose? And just an analogy with your jobs, you often hear different budgets come in, such as we're here for mental health and addiction and developmental disabilities, and you ask the question, well, what's most important? Well, you're going to hear from us, we're the most important. If you go into the next room and you are sitting down with children and services and so on and so on. It's very interesting to me as we're doing the 3024 planning process, I had 158 persons in our community participate, and that included members of the Child and Family Commission. And when I asked them, I said, we have to prioritize services here. We're in a very limited funding situation. Can you do that? They did. Their number one first priority choice, both for adult and children, were crisis services. And that's what we've eliminated 100% right now in the state, except for the Oregon Health Plan Plus population. And then you can see on page 10 how they also rated services for youth and adults after crisis services was adjusted. It was interesting to me for youth that they named family therapy and case management as well as adults. That was one of their top two choices. Turning to 11, in an environment of limited funds, I think we need newer and simpler models of doing business. And I've listed a number of recommendations, which I know you have all heard and you're grappling with under your mental health subgroup. So I won't go after them one by one, but just to say you've got a tough job. I also wanted to mention I was at a meeting with the Association of Oregon Mental Health Programs, and we had about the best and the brightest in there from the OMAS and also from the mental health and addictions people from the state and also from Medicaid. And I asked one question. I have $100,000 today to give you. I want to match that and make it $160,000. If I had $60,000 more, I could continue my 24/7 crisis coverage this year. Tell me how to do it. I couldn't get any really good answer. What I heard is we're going to have to amend our state Medicaid program. That's going to take such and such. There's a lot of administrative things to do. I think we need to start thinking out of the box and coming up with those solutions and answering those questions. And then lastly, on page 12, this is my pessimism and job experience. I know you've heard this all. So I'm going to end my testimony with, we're all going to die, die or go to jail. It's the end of life as we know it. Thank you.
Signy dies the end of our life.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Or if the revenue continues to fall, just the beginning. One small correction, Sharon. You mentioned we had a $12 billion budget. We had a $12 billion budget. It's now down to 10. It's why you're sitting here. It's why we're sitting here contemplating these very Hobson's choices. Representative Andrews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give me, I realize there's a bell curve of people on the whole curve, but could you tell me how percentage of these folks are healthy, basically? Are they out and around most of the time, except when they're affected by, for instance, lack of medication, if they're in treatment? Or are they viable? Are they ambulatory? Do most of them need hospital care?
Representative Anderson, I would say that fully, almost 100% of the people that we serve in Mid-Columbia are ambulatory. They can meet their basic needs, but probably about 30% of those people can do so with intensive wraparound services in terms of case management, assistance to get to their medical appointments, some type of daily structure program. We have a consumer drop-in center that we have about 40 or 50 clients participate in daily. And then probably 20% of those clients, due to the nature of their illness, are pretty functional. They are working. They may be suffering from depression, anxiety, but with some medication and also some very brief counseling, they do fine.
So you're saying 30% and 20%, about 50% are really able to be out on the street with some help coming in for counseling at times?
Well, Representative Anderson, I'd like to, we do not have any group homes or residential homes in my four counties. What we have is we have what's called supportive housing services for those clients that that 40% that I said needed the wraparound services, and they are living independently in apartments, and our case managers go and assist them with whatever it is that they need assistance with. Might be shopping or, you know, helping them pay their bills. But we do not have, if somebody needs to be hospitalized in our four counties, they either go to Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center in Pendleton, or we hospitalize them in Portland. And we may have some in Salem also, but that's a very few.
But I think the key to what Sharon is saying is some of the, however they define it, however they deliver these community-based services that they're no longer able to provide, is what allows that percentage, you know, to be ambulatory and walk around the community, as you call it. Is that a fair statement? Yeah. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sharon, I was curious about your statement on page 10 that the first priority, I assume this, that you concurred with this, that the first priority was crisis services. It seems to me the first priority should be prevention services, preventing somebody from getting into a crisis mode.
Representative Tomei, I would agree. In better times or times that we have now, we do fund the Child and Family Commissions, and we do also have prevention services that we deliver. But I have to quote, and I can't remember the person's name on the local advisory or to DHS board, but he said, right now we're in a situation where we either can do cold prevention or treat the gunshot wound. And right now we're treating the gunshot wound. I'd like to say prevention would be the first thing, but when those people are actively suicidal at your door, then it's a matter of life and death, and that's what we have to respond to.
Follow up? I guess it just seems that it's better to prevent somebody getting into that position. It's more cost efficient, as well as healthier for the person who might be going into crisis mode, to prevent them from going in. But could you talk some about, on page 11, you said get rid of the service element funding. Talk some about that.
Yes, Representative Tomei, on my factoid sheet, which was that page 7?
Was 7 or 11?
Okay, on page 7, though, I pointed out that we are funded under 21 different service elements under our financial assistance agreement. I would like to see those dollars, whatever's left of those dollars, be given to us in a flexible, undedicated source, so that we could take those dollars and see what we can do in the community. For instance, it may be that we have X amount of dollars in one place. If we could use those dollars to, matter of fact, meet that person at the ER room, make sure that they get into our service side instead of the hospital side, that would be a more cost-effective use of those dollars. And as a matter of fact, if I look at my alcohol and drug budget right now, I do have about $150,000 in prevention funds, and If I had the ability to do it, I would take $60,000 of those dollars and keep my 24/7 crisis services to see people that, you know, people that are having acute psychiatric and addiction problems. I don't have that ability now.
I see. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's okay. You can use the BG term here.
BG?
Black grant.
Representative Bates.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. You answered one of my questions already. That was the block grant question. I'd like to expand that question a little bit also, though. We've heard chronically from the people who really supply the services that they are blocked from doing the job they want to do with the very reasons you just mentioned. You have streams of money coming to them that are all tied up in ways they can't move that money where they need to be most effective. So I have two questions along those lines and a couple of follow-ups real quick. The first question is, would it be helpful for you to be able to mix mental health and alcohol and drug programs together and the money for them together, which you've already answered? And secondly, do you have any idea what the administrative cost of getting that money to you is from the time it leaves the taxpayers' hands to actually getting to you, what percentage actually you would receive to use to take care of those patients?
Representative Bates, I can't exactly answer that question, but I can't help thinking when I go back to page 7, when I have funds coming from 6 different DHS agencies, and we have 3 regional organizations in our county that can pass funds, and then 21 different service elements, that there isn't a cost to each of those pieces of business administratively. I know what my administrative costs are, but I can't answer that question for you. That's a great question, though.
Chair?
I think what she's saying is that it's expensive at half the price. Representative Bates.
I would ask if you could get those figures by doing a little cost analysis. I'd love to see them. I don't expect those answers today, if ever. I had 2 other questions, Mr. Chair. On page 11, I'm pretty good about asking questions that everybody else already knows the answer to, or occasionally I do hit a nugget that nobody knows what it means. So I'm going to ask you about two things in this list that I don't have any idea what they are. Get rid of service element funding. What is service element funding?
Well, our services and our financial assistance agreement comes in what they call service elements. So what MHS 20, for instance, means adult mental health, outpatient adult mental health services. MHS 25 means crisis services, and that's both for adults and children. MHS 22 refers to children's mental health services. MHS 37 is special projects, and it goes on and on and on. Like I said, I had 21 of those service elements.
That's the ones you talk about. And that's the ones you want to get rid of. You can meld the money and use it as you think is most effective.
I would like to see that money be flexibly given to the counties, and then the counties accountable for how they're going to spend the money.
Last question, Mr. Chair.
You should be familiar with those numbers, Representative Bates. Those are exactly what's on Barry Cass' work group that we've been, or worksheet that we've been working on.
And you have it memorized?
I'm sure. Absolutely. I got ready to get down the list. No question about that.
Barry here? I need a shovel?
Yeah. I'm saving my watch.
Okay.
Representative Bates.
Last question. Targeted case management. I'm fairly familiar with that term. In the physical side, not necessarily on the mental side, but is the Medicaid plan prescribe you from doing target case management, and also what do you mean by targeted case management in mental health?
Well, targeted case management is a program under Medicaid that allows you to bill for that federal match to provide case management services to persons with mental disorders. And in the state plan right now, you can provide targeted case management to the HIV population, to persons with developmental disabilities, but because of our state plan, mental health isn't included in the state plan. They'd have to amend it so we could get those dollars to help us pay for case management services.
Yes, there will be a follow-up question. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
All right.
The prohibition you're talking about, is that at state level or federal level, or do you know?
Representative Bates, excuse me, I don't understand.
You said that the state does not allow you to bill for case management outside of the areas you just described, HIV and whatnot. The prohibition, does that come from the state or from the federal government, and do you know which it is?
Yes, Representative Bates. Right now, the federal government would allow us to have a targeted case management plan for persons with mental illness, but it has to be written into the state Medicaid plan. So what I was told is that if there was a broad interest, they would have to amend the state Medicaid plan, send it to the federal government for approval, and that process, at least to amend the state plan, would take about 6 to 8 weeks.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
That would be MHS 67, which is not on Barry's sheet, because if I'm getting you correctly, we'd need state match to get the federal dollars.
Well, the question I want to ask goes to that. Are you presently spending county money to do your case management and not being able to get a match for it because of the problem you just described?
Under the Oregon Health Plan, case management is a covered service, and that is being matched with federal dollars. We are using some of the other dollars that we get from the county, from client fees, to augment our case management budget. And certainly if the Oregon Health Plan goes, we are really going to be scrambling to try to stretch those dollars. And we would be allowed to stretch them if we could take advantage of the targeted case management option, even if we put in the 40% so that the state doesn't have to incur that cost, but we could get the 60% match from the federal government.
Could you say that again?
Okay.
I don't get that.
I mean, do you have money that you're presently using that is not matched money? You've been using, and which is a reasonable thing to do, to manage these people who, because of the way our plan is set up, you can't get matched for. If we change that, you would now get matched for. That's a pretty straightforward question. And do you have county funds or other funds you've used that have not come from the state, or even have come from the state, but because of the way this is set up, you can't get the match for? We're looking for match money here.
That's correct, Representative Bates. For dollars that we have now in our budget in the county, there is no mechanism presently for us to get those dollars matched. And that goes back to the comment I meant earlier when we met with the state Medicaid people and also with the people from Mental Health and Addiction Services. I asked, if I had $100,000 to give you today to get that other $60,000 in match from the federal government, how can I do it? And their answer was, we can go back and we can change the state Medicaid plan and go for this targeted case management option. One of the persons from the Office of Mental Health Services actually told me they were doing that match for Multnomah County, but it was very administratively prohibitive. And I don't know exactly what that meant. We were at a big meeting, but we're going to find out, because if it can be done for Multnomah, it should be able to be done for other counties.
Thank you.
That's interesting. Do you get any of the mental health block grant money? It's about $4 million statewide allocated out to counties. And then there's about $30 million of alcohol and drug treatment block grant money. Do you get any of that? How do you use it if you do?
Representative Greenlick, yes, I do. I get about approximately $80,000 from the block grant, and that's divided between the MHS 20 adult outpatient mental health and the MHS 22, the children's mental health, which covers the indigent clients and clients that need sliding fee scale services.
And alcohol and drug treatment, are you involved in any of that?
Yes, we have just under about $1 million in alcohol and drug treatment dollars.
And what's the source of that million? Is that both Oregon Health Plan and block grant money?
For Representative Greenlick, for addiction services, you're asking Oregon.
Well,
let me see. I think I showed you the clients that were covered under that, but I actually have my funding broken down, and it's not included in that sheet. For addiction services under the Oregon Health Plan, we get about $204,000 per year. And then from the state, including both federal and state funds for treatment and prevention, we get probably another about $400,000 per year.
That's not at risk, about $400,000?
Yes, as a matter of fact, under the Oregon Health Plan, the dollars that we got, we used to get paid.
The 400 is not.
The 400,000, that has been reduced already a few times, and we have not been. Well, what I understand, everything's at risk for 2003, 2005, but we haven't been informed that, that those dollars are in jeopardy at this moment.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Sharon? Is that a question?
No.
Thank you very much. Rob?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members.
Thank you.
My name is Rob Roxton. I'm the director of Lane County Health and Human Services. And I have a very different system than Sharon has. And just as a piece of background, I should be very pessimistic using her cartoon. I have 27 years in health and human services. And I think probably after a while you sort of get over the ups and downs and just do what you have to do and make it work. One of the things that's probably a little different about the services I do in our county, I'm heavily involved with the criminal justice system. I've been a member of the PSCC, or the predecessor to that, Public Safety Coordinating Council, or its predecessor, for about 15 years. I run adult parole and probation. I run methadone clinic. I run sex offender programs. Do a lot of court evaluation. So my idea of the system, even though I'm here about...
Oh, you can hit that thing a little closer.
Okay. Okay, is that better there? I'll just hang right in here. Okay.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of the criminal justice system along with the alcohol and drug and mental health. I have public health. I have poverty programs. I have environmental health. So I have quite a variety of different sort of services, which makes me view how I do the world a little differently. Another thing that was a I'll get into when I get into the presentation. One of the things I want to refer you to is the second page, and just a reminder, this is something that Association of Oregon County Community Mental Health, Association of Oregon County Community Mental Health Programs sent out a few months ago. And this is just sort of a gross summary of the legislative cuts. So if you look at the system cuts, and again, you'll see those service elements. Those service elements are all listed on the left side. But primary, you probably really need to know that it shows like $26,900,000 was cut, and that affected 51,000 individuals. If you look at the, one of the things that's significant too on this sheet is, I think, is the 3-1 this weekend it hit basically the Oregon Health Plan standard. You start seeing changes to that. And so there's a big amount there, and it's really different county by county who was affected and what their ratios are in those population bases. And I'll get into that in a minute too. The other thing I just want you, the other thing is probably a little different about our county, too. I just want to make sure it's really clear. Most counties are not in any sort of great fiscal trauma until this occurred. I was not in Multnomah County is an interesting county, has a lot of complicated problems. I know you have an interesting model from Dr. Davidson. We had no such similar problems before all these health plan cuts started to occur. We were a county that was humming along. We're the only county in the state that's owned psychiatric hospital. I own subacute facilities. We own them. We actually work with private nonprofits and for-profits to run a residential system. We're heavily into residential system. So this really pretty much traumatizes our system a lot. I have 32,000 covered lives under the Oregon Health Plan in our county alone. And because Lane County is its size, we are the mental health authority and we are the mental health organization. I am my own region, in effect. And so we do a lot of things a little differently. Plus, in addition, several years ago, Lane County had what we called the sheriff's levy at the time. The mental health, the psychiatric hospital, some of the detox in the community, different sorts of alcohol and drug treatments were funded within that. When Measure 50 rolled around, that actually became county general fund, and we've honored that commitment and kept that county general fund in a psychiatric hospital and kept it in the community and alcohol and drug and other services. So we were not a system that was having any problems prior to this occurring. It was not something we had to redesign the world because it was actually working fairly well. We had good relationships with Peace Health, a major hospital in the area. In fact, they paid me to go to the emergency room 24 hours a day. I served their clients and my clients, in other words, the people who private pays. We actually served them. Their psychiatric hospitals, they staffed that for me. So we have these relationships we just sort of worked out. That's our skills. But recently what happened is because of the funding cuts, I can no longer staff the 24 hours a day at the emergency room. So the behavioral health staff at Peace Health is now staffing that. They're still my psych hospital, but I'm pulling my staff back to work on clients other than doing the emergency room services because it's really expensive, and it basically lost me about the equivalent of five FTE working that service. What you'll see on the placemat, which I will not do to you, we call it the placemat. This is actually a somewhat dated system design of Lane County just for mental health. And within that, you'll see in the middle sort of the links between Lane Care, Lane County Mental Health, and basically surrounding all different levels or all the different sorts of arrays of services we had from all the different providers. We have about 14 different providers of mental health services in our county. So it's a very broad-based system, primarily contracted out. A lot of core services done by the county, like community psychiatry is done by our county. And I think in our county, the private physicians, you know, LIPA, Land Individual Practice Association, they appreciate the fact that we're doing the psychiatric coverage. It's a tough population to deal with, and I have not seen yet a doctor demanding they take my high-end clients into their offices. They're not demanding that yet, but they probably are getting them because as the plan kicked in over this weekend, things are occurring. Changes are happening. If you see on this is 99. It's already changed, and basically what you'll see primarily, if I had to draw one of these today, is a shrinking. Certain things will be eliminated. It's hard for me to figure out, since we have so many not-for-profits and other corporations working with us, what will be their zero base when you do the Oregon Health Plan. Because the reality, we're like nursing homes and hospitals. We're a business. We have to operate. Honestly, don't know yet. It'll be interesting to see what happens, because technically, the trauma has already occurred in the sense that the money is no longer there. It takes a while for the billings and all this stuff to happen, so we'll see it in a little while. But just to understand a little piece of how some of that trauma comes up really quickly, we had an organization called CODA. It was from the Multnomah County area, extended down to our area to do methadone clinics. For whatever reason, we became a methadone capital, had three different clinics within Lane County. Part of it, we pushed on getting methadone clinics set up because several years ago, we had 34 people die in the county of overdoses, which is a lot for Lane County. It's a lot for anywhere. Because March 1st was rolling around, CODA decided because of fiscal reasons they had to close early. So we had all of their clients, I believe it was roughly 200 of them, free-floating in the community unless they could get to another program. My internal methadone clinic picked up about 30 or 40 of them, and Integrated picked up another. But there's a group of them, like 90 different clients floating out there, who, if you understand methadone clients, primarily came from a history of stealing, prostitution, low-level drug dealing. I'm assuming they're somewhat back to that already. I've heard stories, anecdotes, haven't proved them yet. I need to find out about it, about people actually already presented at the emergency room, people already going back to jail, other things already occurring. So I'm not sure, but that was an interesting one that impacted a month earlier. That's the kind of problem we're going to see more and more, and who it really impacts a lot of me is you and me. When I was in Alaska for 6.5 years, one of the things we did a study was that the average heroin addict in Alaska stole 400,000 a year to sustain his or her habit. I have a clue what that equivalent is in Oregon. We start thinking you've got a lot of addicts floating out there and you're not treating them. It's expensive for us, expensive for Mike's case, Eugene Police Department, the Sheriff's Office, jails. It's going to be interesting to see what happens in that arena. And that's just one of the parts of the system that we have.
Can you ask a question about methadone?
What does the actual drug itself cost?
Actually, I don't even know the actual price of the drug itself. I mean, the stuff we put in the tang, that's not the expense. The real expense is primarily really around the monitoring, basically the control and the face-to-face contact, because you can do alternative. Methadone isn't the only drug you can treat it with. I mean, the reality, a lot of heroin addicts don't treat to a methadone clinic. But if you're taking methadone, it's relatively inexpensive, but where it gets expensive is the staffing and all the control. So, for example, it's DEA controlled. You have to have a very, very expensive room to lock it up and stuff. But the drug itself is relatively inexpensive. It's like a lot of things you do with the psychotropics. The drug isn't terribly expensive, but the monitoring and all that stuff is what gets expensive.
And the methadone models have a variety of models about how much a patient can take home. Are there possible ways to, have you thought of any more experimental ways so you can serve many of those heroin addicts on methadone maintenance by finding a less expensive way to deliver the service to them?
Yeah, what you're calling is takeouts. One of the problems you have with takeouts is if you do a lot of takeouts, you can get has street value. I mean, one of the things we found out, for example, I'm not sure where it's popping, it's not methadone, but it's a pill form methadone, which the doctor's been prescribing for pain. That's on the street, very popular. It moves very, very quickly. We also know from enough of our clients, I mean, from their past behavior, they have to show appropriate behavior to get takeouts.
Right.
If something happens and they don't, basically you're asking me, if I could get heroin addicts to perform more like middle-class, straight-up standing citizens, we could probably do a lot more of it. And actually, having said that, a bunch of them are. I'm not trying to denigrate them. But it's an expensive process. And if you ask LIPA, for example, Lane Individual Practice Association in Lane County, they're the prime funder of that through the Oregon Health Plan. 75% of the people in the methadone clinics weren't eligible anymore. That's a weird population base. That's basically a distorted population base. That's why so many of them are out of the system. I'm not sure, but I think that's one of the ideas. I mean, part of the ideas that I'm going to try to get to today is we need to spend more time getting good people together, having a good public policy discussion about what works, what doesn't work, assuming we're not going to really get much more money if we don't get more cuts, and what do you do to triage the remaining money, and who are your priority clients? I mean, I'm trying to force the issue in my county through Public Safety Coordinating Council and other arenas of who is the client we have to deal with today, and to me it's the high-end vulnerable client, of which methadone clients would fall in that category. Again, your issue about prevention. I certainly want to do prevention. The prevention staff all report to me, but they understand right now when I'm on a triage model, they don't seem to be quite as important as making sure I cover the crisis services. But I'm not the expert on that. Just so I understand, I'm not a clinician. I'm an MPA type. I've done this for years. I'm a management type. I understand how this stuff works, but if we really wanted to bring people together, we could talk about it. I'm not personally a fan of saying private doctor's offices can do the drug, just because I've seen 6 deaths related to the pills myself in our county. And if you do it, you got to be pretty controlled. It's got to be a really good program. I think that would be expensive, too, very expensive. But I'm not sure. I'm sure a lot of other people have thought about it. Okay, moving along. One of the things I want to talk about, the cuts that we've had, and it's not just the e-board cuts, the special assessment cuts, the rebalances. One of the things that's occurring in the counties, too, is we're losing general funds. You know, counties where ONC, Oregon, California, timber counties have been losing money over the years, too. So that's a bit significant change for lots of counties. Their general fund is significantly impacted this year, too. And that money is frequently leveraged for other services. So that's going away at the same time, and that's what, sort of what's compounding it. So, for example, my county, too, if I have Public Safety Coordinating Council money going towards treatment, like sex offender treatment, that's getting cut. So there are lots of different pools of money that people don't think about, and the Public Safety Coordinating Council money is from Department of Corrections. That's not within the DHS purview at all. That's definitely Human Services, and it's definitely my same clients. So, for example, I have 350 sex offenders in Lane County. It means 350 of them are on parole and probation, you know, under supervision with my P&P office. And I have in the community probably at any given time about 200 of them actively in treatment, which is primarily a control mechanism. And so we have lots of systems overlap. So this is not just an Oregon Health Plan issue. It's not just a DHS issue. It's Human Services spillover, Department of Corrections, to OIA, to schools, through special, lots of different arenas they spill over in. And one of the things I talked about when I testified in front of another committee previously, too, is a lot of these cuts aren't really cuts. They're just shifts, in effect. You know, if you cut a DARTS program and, you know, a day program for kids and they push them back, they get pushed back to the schools. If the schools get pushed back, they get pushed back to the special ed program. Special ed programs will all tell you with the federal mandates they have, I think it's roughly, they only get funded like 40%. So they're going to get pushed somewhere. And because it's a federal mandate to go back to the schools, you probably shifted the DARTS program back to schools. If you do alcohol and drug cuts like we're seeing, we've already shifted, for example, in our county, the Eugene Police Department, Springfield Police Department, Sheriff's Office, the jails. You shifted a lot there already, and I assume you're going to see shifts to the emergency room. When you start seeing the heroin addicts, when they start doing, you know, getting the open source stuff, they will present the emergency room. When you do copays, like the copay system is really shifted to the provider. These are clients who really don't have the ability to pay. I'm not going to ask somebody who can't feed themselves for another $3 to $5. I mean, we will ask. Chances of getting it aren't terribly good. And it's actually right now cheaper for us to pay it for them than to keep asking them for it. It costs more for me to bill it than to give it to them for free. You know, billing process costs money. You've got to do lots of paperwork. I wish that weren't true, but you have to do that. The crisis fund cuts that we have now, I have $0 in crisis funds. Obviously, crises don't go away. So basically, we're trying to deal with them. Since I have the MHO, we're using some of the managed health the mental health organization funding to pick up some of this funding, at least through June 30th, to see what we can do. We're buying time. But when you cut crisis, you basically just shift it to law enforcement, to emergency rooms again. The one thing I think is really different about this crisis, I've only been in the state 16 years. I wasn't here in the early 80s to see some of the really bad which apparently was bad, but different sort of bad. What's different now, and I think it's not just us, our partners, the hospitals, because of different changes, you know, in DRG rates, different things going on at the federal level, Medicare, Medicaid, they have cut slack in their system. There's no longer a lot of capacity with beds. And one of the things I'm actively involved in, a health alert network, is public health side, the Homeland Security. It's been going on for years, and I'm actively part of that. One of the things we know, there's an assumption of capacity to have a bioterrorism incident to get people to hospitals. Excuse me, there is not. Hospitals have given that slack up years ago. If you had a significant bioterrorism event, they do not have the ability to put people in hospital beds. So our partners are sort of drying up. In the past, when we had a client blowout, whether it was a development disabled client, a mental health client, our answer was always, oh, go ship them to Eastern Oregon. There's always room at the inn. There's no room at the inn anymore. So it's, I think, different this time. A lot of high-end clients with actually nowhere to go. So quite literally, I think what will happen, and some of the questions you were asking earlier, I think sometimes when somebody comes out of state prison, when they come out of a state hospital, when they come out of our local acute hospital, where they really end up is with a family member sometimes. Other times they get dropped off at the mission, which everybody seems to have one of those. Or they get dropped off with somebody else, a friend in an apartment, and they blow out within a few days. The reality is they get dropped off. It's not like it's a real smooth transferred system. Another thing that we just understand too, extended care management unit basically gave us notice a while ago that people that are in my hospital who are committed to the state, they were reimbursing me. But effective January 31st, different from some of these other cuts, they're no longer reimbursed. So we have people actually are committed to the state who are sitting in our hospitals. And it's a double-edged sword because I have no capacity. Plus, when I do a Medicare audit later on, Medicare almost always seems to dig me money, and I don't go back to state and charge them for their portion of it because it gets too complicated.
Robert, you were talking so fast, sometimes it's hard for me to catch up.
Okay.
Okay, talk about ECMU reimbursements for committed patients. Say
it slowly.
Say it slowly so that your
sense.
Grandmother would understand.
My grandmother. We're paying money for the state. She'd understand that part. These are committed patients. They've gone through the civil commitment process. It means they're legally committed to the state. But because there's no room at the inn, I'm not trying to badmouth the state, there's no room at the inn and no funding there, the state will reimburse us for keeping them in our local hospital. What has happened, though, because they were running out of funding, they gave us notice that of January 31st.
They meaning?
The state. I'm sorry, state mental health, HOMAS, would no longer reimburse. So we wrote a letter back saying, that's fine, but when they're committed, we will give them to you in the future. And we haven't had to push that yet because people have managed to try to work it out. But it means quite literally they are jammed for space and we're jammed for space and not getting reimbursed. It's just a shift. But it's if you have somebody who's committed, our county is willing, if the state couldn't get a bed, to do a warrant. It's called a warrant. Get a judge to issue an order. The state hospital has to take them because they legally are committed to the state. I mean, it's not the kind of thing you really want to push, but it is a legal commitment. In the past, that's where they went. In fact, we would make an argument. In fact, we do have a proposal for the state right now that we want to do a pilot in Lane County. Since we own our own psych hospital, own subacute facilities, and do a lot, we're asking them, please carve out the money you get for hospitalization of the state for child and adult. Give us the money. We will manage the system for you.
I'm going to go back several sentences.
Okay.
So you're saying, if I may, Mr. Chair, thank you, that if somebody's committed to the hospital and the state hospital is full,
mm-hmm.
So then they're going to be committed to the local hospital, your local hospital. Is that what you're saying?
They're committed to the state hospital and they're residing in our local hospital.
But there is, okay.
Commitment is a legal word.
Okay. And they're going to continue to be funded by the state, or they're not going to be?
No, January 31st, they stopped that funding.
So then what did you do with that patient?
Well, actually, what we did, since they gave us notice, we did what was reasonable, basically got the people out of the acute facility, because most people are in an acute facility, you know, 7 to 10 days anyway, and got them into a subacute facility, because we have a subacute facility. If you do
and
not
did
have
a... the state continue to pay then?
There's some payment for the subacute. Some of the money we have, yes, there's some funding there. The problem we're running into is there's more clients needing the beds than beds available. A problem locally and a problem at the state. There's demand for beds everywhere.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And so what we did is, rather than we got proactive, we're not considering just watch everything. To a certain degree, we have to watch because we don't get a lot of choice. We didn't choose to get the budget cut $2.5 billion. I mean, it's the state revenues just were that much smaller. What we have done internally is we have temporarily shifted funding for crisis services. That basically we're going to pay for them internally at least for a few more months. We'll just absorb them through some of our reserves and some of the money we have in other parts of our system. We are actually looking at contracting for pharmacy because pharmacy is still going to be a touchy issue. I'm not sure how well that will work. We have a private for-profit firm coming in, actually operating out of our clinic. But how will it really work when a whole bunch of clients no longer have, well, of course, now they're going to get the medical benefit. But it's interesting, some of the clients are going to get the pharmacy prescription still won't be our clients anyway because they can't have the service. It's going to be sort of this strange system. It's going to be very, very odd for a while. But we're working on getting pharmacy for people when we can. Another thing you need to know about pharmacy, pharmaceutical firms for years have had programs to try to do prescriptions for people at a subsidized level. There's such a high demand now that basically they're going to be able to do less people and do it for a shorter period of time. So it's less available. I'm assuming they're working on that, but we're being told there's just going to be less available. In our community, what we are going to try to do, I'm personally trying to advocate to get the Oregon Health Plan changed. And I think one of the things the Oregon Health Plan was good about doing was getting access to people. People to services. One of the bad things they did is gave access. For example, within access and mental health, Oregon Health Plan, I have Blue Cross coverage. Somebody in Oregon Health Plan has better mental health coverage than I do, which is sort of just an oddity. So if we look at how we design packages, we can probably do something a bit differently. But what I would like to see is if we can still guarantee access, there's lots of federally qualified health centers in the state. In Lane County, we're going to work on, we got a bid in to do an FQHC. We have a rating of 98%. I assume things we're going to get one. That way, we can give some access and actually get some money. It's different than the state system in the sense that, at least today, they're paying on what your cost is. So you can actually give some access to clients who have lost access previously. How many people I'm going to be able to pick up that system, I have no idea. But we will do as many as we can. The other thing we're going to do is we are going to continue to pay client co-pays for a while because this makes some sense for us because the co-pay is actually it's very big for a lot of the clients but relatively small for us. But we can't do it forever. The last issue I have revolves around what I think the state needs to do. I mean, I really do think we need to revisit the Oregon Health Plan in total, not just tweak it. And I know in talking to state people, to revisit the whole Oregon Health Plan. I mean, we all know that basically what we're hearing that it's just enough funding to cover the mandated. And part of that means that maybe what we need to do is talk about the benefit packages and everything else. But I'm trying to figure out, it really takes an expert group way beyond me. When I listen to the people talking about Medicaid match, this is some pretty technical stuff. But if we can get an agreement about a public policy discussion that the public's obligation is to protect high and vulnerable people, which I've not heard anybody actually argue, that is the public policy argument. I think most people agree with that. We haven't had that stated yet publicly. That we'd probably look a bit differently how we'd move money around. Because the argument would be is not everybody who's high and vulnerable client is on the Oregon Health Plan. Either sometimes they're applying for it or they just have a few dollars too much to apply for it, yet they still are the same public client that sees the police, sees the sheriff in the jail, goes to the state institution. We need to have a conversation. What's the appropriate balance between access to services based on poverty and access to services based on acuity, you know, based on need? I call them high-end public clients. I want that discussion. Another thing I think we need to have a discussion on for possibilities, not assuming I have more money, but then again, I can shift it differently, and that is human service funding, not just within DHS, but you have self-sufficiency, child welfare, and have us with alcohol and drug and mental health money in the state in that area. But also, Oregon Youth Authority has money for alcohol and drug. You have commissions, children and family have money. They have different agencies. And if we could figure a way to pull the pots, and we have a discussion simultaneously about who are the clients we really want to protect, and at the same time still do some prevention work, how would you do it? But it almost would take a summit on not on the Oregon Health Plan, not a summit on it's a summit on funding. How do you want to move funding and what do you really think the policy choices ought to be between the state and the counties about who our clients are?
Any questions?
I just like to comment, if I may. In terms of your last response, was that remember when the Oregon Health Plan was started, there was a values discussion held throughout the state talking about who the priority fund right. ought to be. And the values discussion on the part of the citizen came out much more on the side of primary care and prevention and children's services than it did on the side of the highly vulnerable, high
I agree 100%. Plus, the Oregon Health Plan at first was seven different pieces of legislation, which two or three got enacted that didn't occur. And if you ask, you know, 100% of the population probably wants some sort of primary care coverage. That makes sense. But if you look at the percentage of populations who actually need mental health services in A&D, it's a much smaller proportion. So it's surprising that people say that. I mean, my personal demand is for primary care. I'm not mentally ill most of the time. So, I mean, that is my demand, too, and so I understand that. So, but given my argument, this is a triage time. I mean, people know me. I have two tours in Vietnam. I was there for the Tet Offensive. I know what triages look like. I think we're close to a triage time. This is very, very odd working in a state. This is very surreal. And if you guys see Apocalypse Now, the weirdness, like who's in charge? Nobody. I have this very, very strange feeling. I've been around doing stuff for years. I've never been to the point where when people ask me questions, I can't really respond because I don't know where we're going. There's not agreement on where we're going. But I agree in principle. You're right. If we could have got the original Oregon Health Plan, very, very broad-based coverage for everybody, that's great. We're not getting there right now. The times aren't. That's why I'm doing the FQHC to try to get back to that.
Well, my point is it wasn't intended to be broad-based coverage. It was intended to be narrow-based coverage.
Well, except that all seven pieces of the Oregon Health Plan, if you implemented all of them, would have been relatively broad coverage. I mean, that didn't last terribly long.
Well, I was on the commission that designed it. There were three basic pieces, not seven, but A&D and mental health were really a key piece of your
I just meant pieces of legislation.
Piece of legislation with a high-risk pool, Medicaid yeah. reform, and the small business mandate.
So you'd be good to have in the policy discussion where we want to go, because it really is a good public policy discussion, which I've not heard anybody arguing about lately.
That's what our chair and the chair of the health committee are about here, I think.
We've been doing it for a while. Any other questions? Thank each of you very much for taking time out of your busy days to come be with us and help us. Seeing no other business. We are adjourned.